Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Behind the Case, an ACG Case Reports Journal podcast. My name is Hemish Zaber, and I'm a second-year GI fellow at the University of Virginia and an associate editor for the ACG Case Reports Journal. This month's episode focuses on a case series, sirolimus misuse in refractory Crohn's disease. I'd like to give a warm welcome introduction to the authors of this podcast. First, we have Dr. Rex Su. Rex is a third-year internal medicine resident at Mayo Clinic in Florida. His research interests are focused in IBD and applications of large language models and medical coding for various GI illnesses. At home, he's a husband, dad, and enjoys cooking and baking. Rex, I'm really grateful to call you a friend and colleague, so thank you for taking the time to do this during a busy GI interview season. Welcome, Rex. Rex is joined by two senior authors, Dr. Jamie Kanukin and Dr. Frank Ferrey. Dr. Kanukin is a fellow of the American College of Gastroenterology and senior associate consultant in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Mayo Clinic in Florida. She serves as the director of the IBD Intestinal Ultrasound Program and co-director of Digital Health and Practice Integration for the Department of Medicine. Dr. Kanukin is heavily involved with the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation and currently is the co-chair for the Women and IBD Task Force. Her research interests include looking at the impact of cannabis and IBD and the use of virtual reality on the impact of pain in patients with Crohn's disease. One of her mentees shared with me that Dr. Kanukin enjoys golf, Peloton workouts, Orange Theory, and live music. Welcome, Dr. Kanukin.
Oh, I'm going to find out who did that.
Last, we have Dr. Frank Ferrey. Dr. Ferrey is a master of the American College of Gastroenterology and recipient of the William Carey Award for service to the college. He is a professor of medicine and director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at Mayo Clinic in Florida. Dr. Ferrey has authored or co-authored over 500 original scientific manuscripts, chapters, reviews, and abstracts. His newest book is one for patients titled Mayo Clinic on Crohn's Disease and Ulcerative Colitis, Strategies to Manage IBD and Take Charge of Your Life. Welcome, Dr. Ferrey.
Happy to be here.
All right, friends. It's great to have you all here. Let's get into this article. And so I thought you guys all set the stage for a wonderful introduction on sirolimus and kind of its history. And so sirolimus inhibits T cell activation and proliferation. And we most often recognize its use in solid organ transplant to prevent graft rejection. There's literature to support its use in pediatric patients with Crohn's disease, but limited data on adult patients. This case series showcases four adult patients prescribed sirolimus for medication refractory Crohn's disease after each of them had failed multiple immunomodulators and biologics. The series shares each patient's experience with sirolimus therapy and, for some of the patients, provider recognition of sirolimus-related adverse events, which limited its long-term use as part of their maintenance therapy regimen. So Rex, was there any point in writing this case series that you found challenging? And if so, how did your mentors help you through it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Just kind of approaching it, first off, I really would like to thank Dr. Ferrey and all the other co-authors for their help with this, for which none of this would be possible otherwise. But specifically to the question, I think we had originally approached the topic in wanting to answer and investigate more of the therapeutic response front. And I think after investigations and looking through records, what we had recognized actually was more of, even though for each of the patients, it had shown a positive therapeutic response in some degree, that what we noticed was the degree of adverse event-related limitations to the medications. And I think that shift in having Dr. Ferrey and Kanukin and the others help with kind of framing the response and putting together the data was kind of the challenging bit and the bit that they really helped the most with.
I think that's like such a good point. I think open dialogue with your mentors is so important. And I think one of the fortunate things that you've been fortunate to be exposed to is just mentors who are so approachable and available for you to have those conversations. So that's wonderful. Dr. Kanukin, I wanted to ask you, I often see immunomodulators used in combination with biologics to help maintain remission and help prevent antibody formation against biologics. Which patient of yours do you consider for immunomodulator therapy?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think, you know, really a lot of the evidence and why this came to be, this idea behind combination therapy, and I'm going to use combination therapy in the sense that we also think of combination therapy when we're maybe combining even biologics or different mechanisms. But this in particular, I think the question you're asking is when we combine biologics with different immunomodulators. And that can either be something in azathioprine or Imuran or 6-mercaptopurine, or even there is some data that supports the use of combination therapy with methotrexate. But a lot of that is derived from the SONIC trial, which really was a study that was done in moderate to severe Crohn's patients, looking at the outcomes of patients who received infliximab, one of our anti-TNF biologic monotherapy, as opposed to azathioprine monotherapy, which is an immune modulator, or what happened to those patients when we followed them if they were given both of those drugs, so both infliximab and azathioprine. And really the best outcomes that we saw looking really at 52-week outcomes was that those patients that were on combination therapy really did the best. Some of the post-marketing analysis that was presented several many years ago now at DDW really more pointed towards the drug level of anti-TNF as the association with that better outcome. And so maybe it's the combination effect. We know that immunomodulators can increase drug levels. As you mentioned, immunomodulators reduce formation of anti-drug antibodies, especially in anti-TNF therapies. But maybe it's the combination, that synergy of getting higher drug levels and not necessarily the fact that patients need to be on both. So, you know, which patients do I consider using combination therapy if I'm having this conversation? Well, certainly I'm using it in my high-risk anti-TNF patients. So those are patients that have high-risk disease, worse outcomes, maybe my patients that have penetrating complications or perianal disease, patients that I've had who've formed anti-drug antibodies to other anti-TNFs or other biologics, and I'm going to start a TNF, which is associated with the highest risk for anti-drug antibodies, certainly considering the use of an immunomodulator if there's not an absolute contraindication. I'll point out that I typically am thinking about this more in my younger patients. I really shy away from using it in patients that are over the age of 65 because of increased risk of infection and complications associated with combination therapies. But I'd be interested, you know, in your Dr. Ferre's thoughts on using combination therapy and our non-anti-TNF biologic.
Yeah, I think Dr. Kanookan has kind of hit the nail on the head. Combination therapy with anti-TNFs and either thiopurine or methotrexate has been the standard for many, many years. But with the new biologic agents that we have, immunogenicity is really not an issue. Vedolizumab, ustekinumab, risankizumab, these drugs, we really do not see immunogenicity, and they work quite well as monotherapy. So I continue to use, however, infliximab and azathioprine in my patients, just like Dr. Kanookan, especially those patients with perianal disease, because even prior to the availability of infliximab in 1998, we had very good responses to perianal disease when we treated with full-dose azathioprine. The other point I want to make is that when you're using combination therapy, you need to determine whether you're using it as 1+1=2 or 1+1=3. In other words, low doses of thiopurines or methotrexate can prevent anti-drug antibodies. But if you want to do full dose, if you really have a sick patient with perianal disease, I'll do the full dosing of those drugs.
That's really helpful to know as to whether you're using the therapies for synergistic effect or just in combination of one another. Thank you both for your insight. One of my favorite things about this series is the recognition of sirolimus-related side effects. It kind of took me back to the preclinical years of medical school and pathology. Rex, is there any particular teaching point with your case series that you wanted to share with our audience?
So I think the thing that I was able to really glean away from this as an more of an overarching theme is really being conscious of any possible adverse medication effects or other adverse events to look out for in general. For the patients specific with the case series that we had, there could potentially be opportunities where scaling back on dosages or other modifications to the regimen. And I think we also highlighted on certain values like BMI affecting how certain drugs are tolerated and how wound healing is affected. I think considerations of different things specific to the patient and being conscious of the adverse events that may occur with each prescription and medication that we prescribe would be one of the things at the forefront of what I would want to impart with this case series.
I completely agree. I think having a good understanding of a general patient demographics and their comorbidities plays a lot into whether they should be a good candidate for a therapy or not. And I think you guys did a great job of sharing that in your case series. Dr. Kanookan, I had a question for you.
You know, as a trainee, I often find a difficult time keeping up with the latest literature and what's available to us. There seems to be a huge influx of new biologics and small molecule drugs approved for patients with IBD. What advice do you have for trainees as we see more of these medications in practice and their particular indications?
Yeah, I agree. It is becoming incredibly more complex, and especially as we get more mechanisms, which is great for patient care, it's really important to stay up to date. You know, you may not be aware, or you may have actually completed it last year, that ACG is partnered with NYU and puts on an IBD 101 course, which is really meant to capture every first-year fellow that comes in to fellowship. And we find it when our fellows go through this, when we started it a couple of years ago, that they really have a very high level of baseline knowledge when it comes to inflammatory bowel disease, kind of how to approach these complex patients. So that's something that's available. It's actually happening in the next couple of weeks in Washington, D.C. We've not been in person in a long time. It's been virtual, and it has a standardized patient approach. So that's one way that fellows can stay kind of up to date. The other way, you know, I think that is really important that not a lot of people know about through the ACG is the ACG Education Universe, which is just a compilation of a lot of the different IBD related talks. And they could be medication related too. Program directors can put together a curated curriculum for their fellows. Fellows can access this and be able to put together different things, even outside of inflammatory bowel disease. Say you want to drive home and listen to, you know, so our colleague in Rochester, Susie Kane, talk about updates in IBD therapy. That would be one way you could do that. So you can listen to that. And of course, different podcasts like this. There's IBD Drive and things like that. The Crohn's and Colitis Foundation has excellent resources that are available for both patients and providers that really provide up-to-date IBD-focused education. Mayo Clinic, we have IBD medication resources that we give to our patients. I often find that many of our referring providers are using some of those education-specific. There's many local meetings, there's state meetings, regional meetings. Dr. Foray and Dr. Alishash are hosting our very first Mayo Clinic Florida regional IBD meeting in September. We have some really excellent visiting professors that will be coming. It really is going to shape up to be an excellent agenda, and people can register by going to Mayo Clinic CME and getting more information about our IBD meeting that's happening on September 27th. National meetings, we have several advances in IBD. It's happening in Orlando. The Crohn's and Colitis Foundation puts on one in January. And then there's different weekly things that trainees can be involved in. And I actually encourage all of our trainees to get involved, to get just exposure, maybe even present a case. University of Chicago hosts an IBD program that happens once a month on a Tuesday. The Cleveland Clinic does IBD Live on Thursday mornings. I might be missing some other ones, but those are ones that Dr. Foray and our team has been participating in. So there's really a lot of ways to stay up to date. And I think, you know, being on, you know, the journal watch and looking for those pivotal trials that come out when new therapies are approved for indications is a way to stay up to date. But Dr. Foray, anything I missed in terms of education?
Two other things. If you're a member of the ASGE, every Thursday evening at about 6:30 Eastern Standard Time, there's a blast to ASGE members, which is IBD Journal Watch, which is a series of authors who basically are reviewing articles for ASGE members. And I would encourage you, if you're a member, and all fellows should be a member, to get that. They also get access to the journal. And Rex may not remember this, but this whole idea of looking at sirolimus came up after attending one of the Miguel Ruggiero's IBD Live from Cleveland Clinic. There was a pediatric case that was using sirolimus with an excellent response, and that perked my interest. And given the fact that Rex was looking for a project, we tasked him with looking at the Mayo Clinic experience. And so the case series basically are a series of patients seen at Mayo Clinic who were treated with sirolimus. And I can't tell you how much I enjoy the IBD Live program every Thursday morning, 7 a.m. EST, because I even learned so much from that program.
It's so reassuring to hear from the both of you what resources are available to us as trainees. And I've been a big utilizer of the ACG Learning Universe and the ASGE Journal Scan. That weekly update is really nice to kind of get a nice synopsis of ongoing trials and recent publications. So thank you both for your service with that.
I forgot actually one more. Can I interrupt? I think
absolutely.
One for our Twitter followers, Monday Night IBD is actually a really great resource. Yes. It brings together the Twitter community, and there's like Tuesday Night IBS, and there's Sunday Scoping. I mean, there's a lot of different platforms that have educational opportunities, but don't want to forget, you know, we've put something on every day of the week
Oceania Twitter is so active. That's a wonderful resource. Awesome. Well, I wanted to end on this. And Dr. Frey, I wanted to get your insight on this particular point of expertise that I know you have. I know that health maintenance is so important in IBD, and you've been a staunch and incredible advocate for this. And so I'd be remiss not to gather your insight. For our patients with IBD, who do you think should take responsibility for their health maintenance in terms of screening for vaccine preventable illnesses, age-related cancer screenings, both health, tobacco cessation? Should it all fall on the PCP? Should the gastroenterologist play a part in this, or should it be a shared process?
Well, that's easier than you think, because although early on when I became interested as a clinical investigator in this topic, and our first paper was actually published in 2010 when I was at Boston Medical Center, the ACG guideline was published in 2019, and I'm happy to report that the new updated guideline is being reviewed right now and should be published by the end of the year, or certainly by January 2025. I initially thought that it was important to partner with the PCP and send the patient back to the PCP to do, for example, get a DEXA scan or, you know, do one thing or refer to dermatology. But when all is said and done, PCPs are quite busy. It's even difficult for us to stay up to date with the newest drugs that are being used to treat patients with inflammatory bowel disease. So you can imagine a primary care doctor who's got to take care of six different organ systems, that they're pretty much overwhelmed. So in the last 10 years or so, I've pretty much taken ownership. I'm prescribing the drugs that can lead to infections. I'm prescribing drugs like, you know, thiopurines that can increase the risk of non-melanoma skin cancer. So I basically take ownership. I recommend vaccinations. I order DEXA scans. When it comes to tobacco cessation, sure, I'm going to send that back to the primary care doctor. Dr. Kanukin, in her position as digital health co-lead, has really helped us develop smart sets in Epic, and I'm sure she'd be more than happy to share them with you. And those smart sets certainly make it easier for you as the gastroenterologist to kind of check the boxes and make sure the patients get their various vaccines and everything else.
You know, that was one of the things I appreciated when I was an intern working in your clinic, that section that you had regarding health maintenance. And one of the things I appreciate is it didn't take that much time to ask them pertinent questions about their vaccination history. Were they up to date on cancer-related screenings, DEXA scan, whatever, what have you? And so that's something that I've definitely carried into my own practice with my own continuity clinic patients. And so I really appreciate you sharing that with me during our time together in clinic. So friends, I've had so much fun reading your case series. I want to thank you all for sharing it with our journal and taking the time to go behind the case with us today. To our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. Please subscribe to the podcast, and I look forward to meeting you all at the ACG National Meeting in Philadelphia. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.